It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 424 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. As always, thanks so much for listening. This week I have great fun talking with Brian Wickman about his upcoming comic, Grit. It's described as Southern fried sword and sorcery and pulp fantasy adventure in the mold of The Witcher by way of Southern Bastards. We talk about the main character, Barrow, and the environment he lives in, and a doomsday cult he's going to run into. Barrow carries an axe for good reason. There are trolls he needs to deal with, apparently. We talk about how this story came to be, as well as other characters that are coming in the rest of the 3-issue miniseries. To make sure you get Grit, you need to get to your local comic shop before March 18 and order MAR202088. Then we also discuss Big White, his first comic, which you can access on his personal website. It's a sci-fi horror story that I really enjoyed and really surprised me, so you won't want to miss it. There's a lot to get to in this episode, so let's get on with the show. It's great to welcome to the podcast Brian Wickman, creator of Big White and a book that's coming out from Scout Comics before long called Grit. How you doing, Brian?
Hey, Wayne, doing great. Having a good night here.
It's good to talk with you. Why don't we dive right in, because Grit's the big thing we need to talk about. And we'll get to Big White a little later. But why don't you tell people what Grit is about?
Grit is a Southern fried sword and sorcery story. I've pitched it as kind of being like the Alabama of Middle Earth. So it's about an aging monster hunter who's not super keen on his job and is especially not so when he's forced to face some unintended consequences when a job goes pretty sour.
How many issues are in Grit?
It'll be a 3-issue miniseries.
Okay, so that'll be good something to do. Now, the reason why we're doing this right up front is because you've only got a little while left to put your order in at the comic shop. This is coming in May, as I understand it, Brian.
Yep, looking at middle of May.
Yeah, so what you need to do is get to your comic shop and let them know you want Grit, because I think it's going to be a real interesting story. I got a chance to read the first issue, which will be out in May, and I think you're going to really enjoy it because it's a very unique story. There's lots of action. One of the things I really enjoyed about it, I give your artist a chance to do some good stuff too, which I think is super cool. Now, talk about the main character. Who's the main guy that the story centers around?
Sure. So the main character is an older gentleman named Barrow. Like you said, the first issue is pretty frenetic in pace. There's a whole lot of action in there. And that's sort of intentional to set up a little deeper look into why he does what he does in the second and third issues. But yeah, so he's been at it a long time. He's sort of a sword for hire, something of a fantasy exterminator. And just an all-around curmudgeonly fella, so which leads to a lot of sort of silliness, because it's a very over-the-top fantasy world with a sort of grounded main character. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's cool. So talk a little bit about I have to say, and I don't want to spoil stuff, but the first thing that happens right out of the gate is something I didn't expect, let's just say. There's a troll problem is what somebody's having.
Yeah.
And talk about that. I mean, what do the trolls have to do with this story?
Sure. So Kevin and I bounced a lot of ideas around, and a lot of the things in the series were born out of these really subtle subversions of like classic fantasy folklore tropes. And one of the things we wanted to do, you know, the troll problem is, it's a classic thing. It goes back to like The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings and all that. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to play with that. And again, I don't want to, it's sort of a gag right off the bat with what the troll problem is. Mm-hmm. And we just found an interesting way to work with not only the sort of weird time crunch that goes along with dealing with a creature that turns to stone in the sunlight. Mm-hmm. But also, what's a funny way that we can approach being hired to hunt trolls? Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, it is a gag right off the bat that sort of spirals out of control pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. Now, the thing I got a kick out was there's the phrase, as soon as you get to page one, there's a phrase on it. And it says, just south of civilization.
Yeah.
I like that phrase because, right, and of course, what we see, let's say the troll performs a bodily function that you don't often see in comics. Heck, you don't often see on television. There was just a joke about the fact the Enterprise never had a bathroom in it.
Right.
And okay, so we see something that would happen in the bathrooms starts at the very beginning, which, of course, lets you know this is not going to be a highbrow kind of story. I guess we're not going to see that very much.
Yeah. I've always loved fantasy that sort of doesn't take itself too seriously, and I wanted to establish that very early on. Especially because, like you said, this issue in particular is so action-heavy that I sort of needed a laugh out of the gate to even that out.
Mm-hmm. Now, talk to me about how the trolls relate to the humans, because it looks to me like when they discover a troll seems to be larger than a human being is.
Yeah. So I approach them as sort of these lumbering creatures, and there's a lot of sort of fantasy nonsense scattered in there. We have a run-in with some goblins in issue one, which are a little more sort of mischievous critters that kind of gang up. But so the trolls are being used for a purpose, and that's the kind of thing that I dig into later in the series, is just sort of the relationship between, you know, groups of people. I mean, I say right in the solicitation, there's a sort of doomsday cult at the heart of this story, who aren't very good at what they do and sort of accidentally get things right, and then it doesn't go so well for them. I'm really intrigued by the idea of, like, so you want the world to end, but why, and what happens next?
Mm-hmm.
So we have this sort of bumbling cult who are using these, you know, fantasy creatures to a certain end that I don't want to spoil, because that's sort of, you know, things hinge on that. But I'm really intrigued by this sort of, like, I always think it's heavy-handed to say, well, that monster had a family, isn't it sad that it's been killed? But I think I approach that from sort of a fun, I like to poke that idea from a lot of different directions.
Mm-hmm. Now, what are the weapons that Barrow uses? I think he's largely knives and axes, looks like.
Yeah, so he carries sort of a hatchet and a machete. I like to give him sort of a working man's weapon. So he's very fond of his axe. He talks to it at one point.
Now, he has the problem that I always thought the Black Knight had in Marvel. The Black Knight had a sword, and they saddled him with this notion that he can't use the sword, or if he does, bad things happen to him. Now, Barrow doesn't have that problem.
No, not remotely.
Let's just say that he uses his tools a lot, especially in the first issue. And we get to see pieces of trolls that I didn't really expect I would see, shall we say. It's very, very creative. I have to ask, of course. When you wrote this, did you come up with the sequences as they were going to happen? Did your artist develop that? Did you do it together? How did you – because action in comics is something – because, you know, it's like on a television. They have to plan out all the sequences that are going to happen. First, you're going to punch this person. The person's going to punch you back. You have to plan out these things. Did you guys plan this all out? Did you come up with it? Did the artist do it? How'd you get that to happen?
Yeah, so there are a handful of pretty action-heavy pages in this first issue. And depending on what needed to get done on the page, I would leave notes. But Kevin and I have a really good – Kevin Castanero is the artist on the book. He's brilliant, a ton of energy in every page he does. You know, I really trust artists that I work with to be better at the visual aspect of this creation than I am. So that's a note that I give everyone early on, is if you disagree with the choice that I made in the script, you should do what you think is going to, you know, read best on the page. Mm-hmm. So there's one page in particular that where I think Kevin sort of channels a Jeff Darrow Shaolin cowboy kind of brutality. And I think I only wrote one of the panels on that. I said, well, I need this to be the last panel, but for the rest of it, you know what? Go wild. And, you know, he sent me a lot of thumbnails and we went back and forth a little bit, but, you know, he knocked it out of the park.
Because, you know, action in... See, this is where I think this book would just be ideal for, like, a Netflix kind of series or something. This, even an animated kind of a thing, even though it's a little grittier than a lot of... a lot of animation tends to be very sterile and clean, and, you know, you don't get a lot of this kind of axe-wielding that we get in this book. So this is kind of a little... If you're not ready for it, it might be a little... startling to start off with. So why start out this way? Why have all these good things happening like this? Is there something you're trying to accomplish as far as the story goes?
Yeah, absolutely. So I would say that, again, it's a pretty condensed miniseries at 3 issues, and each one is a very it's very tonally distinct from the other issues. So issue one reads like a pretty straightforward, you know, old school pulp fantasy adventure with maybe a couple of gags thrown in that you wouldn't find in a Conan book. Mm-hmm. But then I really start to push that in different directions with issues 2 and 3, where issue 2, I've said a couple of places, it's kind of, it really pushes the humor in this and really examines just how over the top the sort of chaotic, constant violence in issue 1 is, because it introduces another character who is this sort of, hot-tempered young witch who takes offense to this sort of brutality. And she has a really interesting relationship with pacifism in that she is aggressively pacifistic. Mm-hmm. So when she sort of butts heads with Barrow in issue 2, that's where we start to sort of pick apart the action that dominated issue 1. Mm-hmm. And then issue 3 just... you know, we get there, but that it goes in some wacky directions from there. I would say the pace sort of slows down in the back 2/3 of the story, but it becomes a little more introspective and really pulls out just how over the top, you know, these sort of pulp heroes can be. Your Conans and your Fafford and Gray Mouser, all this sort of senseless violence is... You know, Kevin has a very exaggerated style where I feel like it pushes more cartoony than grotesque, even when there's, you know, extensive gore. Like, it's still kind of fun to look at, which I didn't want to beat anyone over the head for enjoying that part of the story because, you know, it's fun to cut up monsters with a sword, you know? Mm-hmm. But I do want to sort of ask the question of like, well, maybe there's a better way to solve that problem than hacking it to pieces.
Well, one of the things I enjoyed about the art was the use of motion. You know, so often you'll have like an arm and you have lines after it showing you that the arm has moved. That's not the way he does this stuff. Oftentimes there's a blur. That, yeah. In other words, this is so fast, you can't even see how fast he's moving.
One of the fun things that Kevin does is in particularly chaotic panels, he'll leave more of his pencils in beneath the ink, so you get this sort of almost, you know, sketchy looking finished art once the colors go over that, which I think really lends to that sort of frantic action.
Mm-hmm. Which is really cool. It is something interesting. The good thing about this was I don't, you know, I'm not much for a lot of violence in the darkest sense of the word, but this stuff goes so fast, and you see so much going on that you kind of have to pay attention to get the story as to what in the world now is happening. Like I said, there's times when there's just blurs of motion. You have to look and say, what is that? What's going on?
Yeah.
Which I like. And that propels the story along quite nicely. And the good news is, let's just say that the bad guys don't necessarily know what's going to happen next.
No. What I'm getting at with this sort of bumbling doomsday cult is even they're not sure what their end game is, which I think is a funny way to approach that.
Mm-hmm. Which is, there's a particularly couple of things when I just went, oh, you know. Yep. And I don't want to say which ones they are. I think anybody picking up this book will get a pretty good idea. Yeah. And usually there's the bad guys, especially in this kind of a book, there is a big force involved that makes things happen. And like we said, the bad guys don't necessarily understand what this big force is going to accomplish at certain times, shall we say. So, one of the colors that's dominant in this book is red, which tell you a little something about that. Which leads me to the colors. I mean, who did the colors in this book?
Simon Goff, brilliant, brilliant colorist. Man, he just every, you know, it's amazing to see a book come together, but that's the point at which it feels complete, you know, like when you start to see, man, I think I got a little weepy when I saw the last page of this issue finished, where it takes a different color palette. But man, just beautiful work he does.
Cause a lot of the stuff, like I said, red is a dominant color. It's in there. Mm-hmm. The other colors tend to be more subtle in the color palette. He'll do light greens, blue greens kind of stuff. There's the shirt that Barrow wears is white, but it's not a bright white. In other words, he's been wearing this for a while, clearly in his work. So it's not necessarily a bright white shirt that somebody would wear. And the other things that go around, the trees and stuff is going around, they're all pretty much subdued colors, which is good. But then we get to, I talked about this big force. The big force is. I said there was a lot of red. There's a lot of red involved in the, so we say, the big force of things, and he invokes a lot there. It invokes. I don't want to imply a gender here, but it invokes a lot of red as it moves, including. I can't spoil it, but let's just say I mentioned the bad guys don't know what's all going to happen.
Yeah.
And there's a particularly, for me anyway, an enjoyable one where the bad guys don't know what's going to happen. So more than that, I'm not going to say, but that actually, that was the place I went, oh, and then I went, ha.
Yeah. There's a couple satisfying little moments tucked in there. Yeah.
It's really cool. It's got a very, like I said, I love a fast moving story, because a lot of the times in comics, the word balloons take me a while to get through.
Yeah, I feel like I stayed out of the way in this one. I let everyone else do their jobs, and they made me look very good.
There's dialogue going on, and occasionally, and it's important to the story, obviously, as we move forward. So the good news is you didn't, you know, the word balloons don't dominate the panel, shall we say, all the time. They appear sometimes, and like I said, it's important to read them when they happen. But a lot of the times, it's just, you know, it's action and adventure. Yeah. And actually, like I said, it's nice to read something like that for a change.
Yeah, this issue propels forward very quickly. It's a very fast read. And then, like I said, the rest of the series revisits a lot of the moments from the first and sort of picks those apart. Mm-hmm. I'm not particularly drawn to, like, inner monologue. I like to sort of get through context, not that I have anything against it when it's well done. It's just not necessarily my style for this book. Mm-hmm. And I think that is part of why I stayed out of the way. It would have been really easy to sort of, you know, get inside of Barrow's head while all these awful things are happening. Mm-hmm. But I kind of just allowed that to happen through a series of grimaces that Kevin put on his face.
But you know, that isn't that a challenge though for a writer? I mean, Spider-Man is forever throwing quips around and stuff like that. And, you know, that gives the writer something to do. You know, they certain writers, and I could name names, but I won't, like big word balloons and like lots and lots of dialogue. There's the one issue of a Spider-Man where Peter Parker tells Aunt May, and it takes him the whole issue, that he's actually Spider-Man. And there's this dialogue going on endlessly. And it felt like, to me anyway. And so your book doesn't approach it like that, thankfully. But as a writer, though, you don't feel cheated, you know, if you're not putting lots of words in. Because I just get the sense some writers do. They feel like they got to have a certain number of words on a page, or they're not doing their job, it feels like.
Yeah, I mean, trust me, there was plenty of editing that went into it. but at the end of the day, it became less is more. And how little could I say and still tell the story that I wanted to get across? Because Barrow, at the end of the day, is a man of few words, so mm-hmm. there's no reason for me to force that on the character mm-hmm. for my own ego, you know? There's plenty of room for that in issues 2 and 3 when this loudmouth, you know, sort of boisterous witch shows up and, you know, really rattles the story a bit. Mm-hmm. And even so, a lot of times Barrow's dialogue and response will be a series of grunts or two-word answers because that's who he is. Mm-hmm. And I think you get that sense very quickly from when he's introduced to his job on the first couple of pages. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the pages I've already showed off, it's almost threatening the way that he speaks to someone who just hired him mm-hmm. because he's so short, where they mention they're heading out, and he says, well, people aren't hard to track. And it's like, well, you're a guy with an awful lot of weapons, and they just paid you for a job, bud. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things I enjoyed, too, about the color of things was that when the trolls talk, the trolls tend to be like a green, lime green, well, not lime, but more of a subdued green.
Like a teal.
Yeah, and when they talk, their word balloons are in something similar to that, which I find interesting. Of course, what that says is that their voices tend to sound differently than a human would sound.
Yeah, so Micah Myers does letters for this. He's phenomenal. He's done a handful of books with Scout and, you know, numerous other things. I think his first book with Image out recently. Yeah, phenomenal guy. Great, great fella. Great letterer. Again, I trust my team to do what they think is going to suit the book. So that wasn't necessarily a direction for me. He just sort of picked out, well, these are a little more, you know, bestial than the humans in the world. And he gave them, you know, the lettering is a little different from when everyone else speaks. And there's a little tint to the word balloons. He does the same thing with some of the, you know, bigger forces you mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. And that becomes especially important later in the series as you sort of track, you know, the path that those forces take. So Micah really helped clear things up in terms of a through line mm-hmm. of sort of tracking the villainous forces throughout the book.
Mm-hmm. And you know who's saying what.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Very, very easily. Because sometimes if there's, well, not just, I always said there's not a lot of word balloons, but it is good to know specifically who's speaking. Because sometimes yeah. they're speaking off panel, and when the color of the word balloon is different and kind of identifies who it is, right. you know, that makes reading a lot easier.
Yeah, yeah. And I think stylistically it's just interesting too. You know, in a there aren't a ton of characters in this issue or even in this series, really. It only ever really winds up with a handful of people introduced. And to make them all feel like they have their own voice in a sort of way that matches the aesthetic of the book, I think was a good call on his part.
Mm-hmm. Now, what I like about Barrow is Barrow never smiles.
No.
He's always got a grimace on his face. Yeah. You know, even when somebody is saying something that he agrees with or likes, it's still sort of,
Yeah, yeah. He's a grumpy old fella. I will, you know, Wayne, you heard it here first. He does smile one time in the series.
Oh, boy.
So I'll stand keep on reading for that smile.
That'll be fun. That'll be something really interesting to see when that happens. Because
yep, yeah.
First issue, I guarantee it's not there.
Not a one.
What's funny is every once in a while he does those little grunts or huhs or something like that about it. But the great thing about it is his character doesn't have to say more than that. When he says something like that, it's his emotion level doesn't vary too much in pitch. So when he says certain things, it means he's responding in a certain way. You know, if something kind of surprises him, he kind of goes, huh. You
know? Yeah, and that's just about as much as you get out of him, which I think is – it's his way of interacting with the environment. And that's frequent. Like you said, that's what it is. When he has an idea or notices something interesting or even sees something horrifying, he doesn't seem particularly rattled, which I think is a testament to how much he's seen in his lifetime. It's intentional that he's been at this a long time and isn't particularly shocked by things that, you know, other characters he comes across would be. He's sort of desensitized to it in a way. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we get around to picking apart why that's, you know, initially kind of you get a chuckle out of that response. And then you're like, well, this is actually kind of sad. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a little more tragedy to Barrow than issue one lets on. You get a little – you get some peeks into that with some dialogue about him.
Yeah.
But it doesn't really get opened up until later in the series.
Yeah, he's very much the kind of character that the people around him do a lot of the talking.
Yeah.
Which is fun because it's like when Batman – when they did Batman the Animated Series and they went over from Fox to Kids WB, they specifically decided Batman was not going to say very much. Mm-hmm. And so when he spoke, it was important. And that's kind of the way he does. When he says something, there is – sometimes there's a pause and he's getting to something important to say. And you get to understand the character through that a lot. And I think that's really, really good about that because it's easy to write lots of words, in my opinion, to pare this down to where he's just, you know, he is saying only certain things and that's pretty much all he's going to say. Using that vocabulary effectively is, I think, a lot harder than big word balloons. So I think you did a really good job on that and keeping it minimized and still effective.
Yeah, and that's definitely a through line for Barrow. You know, even as he, you know, acquires some strange traveling companions through the course of the series, he there's no wavering with his personality. He's very much that sort of almost reserved, you know, gruff individual, no matter how much people are talking at him.
Mm-hmm. Well, the cover makes me smile on some levels. There he is standing there with his implements kind of dripping with blood, and around him are butterflies.
Yep.
I'm looking going like, that's interesting. The butterflies are kind of like, this happens all the time.
Yeah, and you'll find the butterflies in every issue. That was a through line. Yeah. One of Simon's favorite parts, actually. He loved finding them in the yarn, you know, throwing little splashes of color. I mean, you talk about how it is sort of a drab color palette, and intentionally so, because it's a world that should feel lived in. Like, much the way people talk about the set dressings in Star Wars, it should feel like this is a world that's, you know, worn down. Mm-hmm. So those splashes of things like red, and there's a beautiful panel where the sun sets, and mm-hmm. you get all these sudden purples, and that initiates a real shift in tone for the issue. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there's little things like these bright blue butterflies that sort of dot the background. They're just these interesting little notes. It's a very graphic, sort of intense issue, mm-hmm. but I don't like worlds that are grim. At no point did I want this book to feel heavy, even mm-hmm. though such, you know, violent things are taking place. It should still feel like a fantasy world that people are, like, having fun with.
Well, see, it's a contrast in some levels. You know, you've got all this stuff going on. There's movement and action, and in the meantime, the background is none of that. It's very stable. It's, you know, very kind of average on some levels. The trees look pretty average, and there's little things growing on them and stuff like that. And even, you know, what Barrow wears is kind of average stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But there's this unaverage stuff happening around all this average thing. Yeah. And that's what makes it kind of stand out. You know, it pops out more because you've got the real, you know, sort of dullish colors, and contrast that to what the stuff is happening around in that environment, and it really makes it pop out of the page, I think.
And that's the kind of stuff that I find entertaining, is I like these sort of, I don't want to say average, but it's a very, you know, it is what it is in this world. You know, this is another day in this bizarro, you know, sword and sorcery landscape. And I think it's fun to juxtapose this sort of another day at the office approach to monster hunting.
Mm-hmm. It feels like it's a kind of an autumn or fall feel to it.
Yeah.
So it's one of the things. It's one of my least favorite seasons is autumn, because what's coming next is going to be winter.
Right. Yeah.
And so I'm kind of like, oh gosh, and I know what's coming next. And you get that sense from this too, and that this is starting to get darker, and it's starting to turn in a colder and less friendly way, let's say, than summer is.
Yeah, I think that folks will be surprised to see the pivots that it takes later on, because it's sort of issue one ends on sort of a, I don't want to say a disheartening note, but the series becomes, if anything, more fun from there.
It's a big surprising note that happens, and I'm not going to talk what it is, because it's a big surprise when it happens. I'm like, uh-oh. Yeah, it's moment. So I'm like, ooh.
And I think what's especially fun is we don't get back to that uh-oh moment right away. Mm-hmm. So you're left to linger knowing that that happens.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's a couple of things I'm curious about.
Sure.
And if it's going to spoil stuff, don't just tell me and we won't worry about it anymore.
Sure, of course.
There are on a couple of trees a symbol.
Yes.
Is that Barrow's symbol? Is it something that's going to be revealed later in the story that we shouldn't know right now?
So, yeah, it's actually on the cover of the book, too. It's on that tree right behind Barrow. Mm-hmm. That is, admittedly, Kevin and I did a lot of poking around and getting these sort of demonic sigils from different sources we could find. And we settled on that one, and we decided that, again, we talked about this sort of bumbling doomsday cult. And I like the idea of them almost like teenagers scratching pentagrams into their binders. They have just defaced the forest with this.
Oh, so it's like so-and-so likes so-and-so kind of thing as far as they're
concerned. Yep, except so-and-so likes, you know, demons.
Yeah, it's them identifying that they've been there.
Right.
Okay, I get
it. And it is a through line. You'll see it crop up a couple of times. Mm-hmm. Because, again, these bumbling cultists are in some ways more successful than they realized at doing what they do. It does remain a through line, but yeah, it was again, one of those things that we just thought, well, you know, it's the fantasy equivalent of graffiti to me.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's the human making a mark.
Right.
That's okay. Now, another question I've got, and I'm always interested in why things are the way they are. The character's name is Barrow. We've got other things going on. Why is it called Grit?
I think there's a couple of reasons. One just being sort of, it's kind of a buzzword right now, actually, which is an unintentional use, but grit, I would say, is the sort of mental fortitude that Barrow has to keep doing what he does. That scowl is not entirely because he's a grumpy fella, but he's been sort of subject to this violence, and in some ways of his own choice. But he, you know, that would have to take a toll on an individual, and it certainly has. And for him to feel this sort of obligation to keep at, you know, his view on protecting folks, albeit for pay, it requires a certain level of mental fortitude, I think, is the best way to put it. But also, there's just, in some ways, this is my, you know, wacky fantasy Western in terms of world building. And, you know, the word grit is, for any number of reasons, associated with that genre. So it plays into that as well. But also just stylistically, I think that the word grit aesthetically fits this world. You've talked about the sort of drab lived-in color palette and Kevin's kind of, you know, blurry, sort of scratchy style sometimes. And I think that if there's one word that sort of works for the book, grit is it.
Okay, because I talked about the color red, and when you look at the title of the book, it looks like somebody took blood and with their finger wrote the word grit.
Yep. And that very well may be what Micah did when he put that title together, for all I know. Because I know that he had some fun with that one. But yeah, no, it feels very much like someone smeared it on the cover of the book.
Yeah, it doesn't look to me like, it doesn't look designed so much to me as it was put there by somebody. Well, of course, you never know. It could be Barrow put it there, as far as we know. That could be his handwriting on there, as far as we know, because it's just it's a fascinating way to do that, because, you know, I'm used to logos and things on comics to be bright and bold and fun and stuff. And here's this handwriting in blood on the top of this book. You know, like I said, the first panel gives us an idea what the tone of the book is going to be. But even the cover gives us hints towards that.
Yeah.
So it's a lot of fun like that. Now, you got three issues, and of course, the first one's coming out in May. It's going to be monthly. After that. So, okay, good. And are you going to collect it after it's done?
We will collect it, and there's some interesting stuff going on with that. So the trade paperback will have three additional short stories set in this world with three other artists, Simon Kirks, Dylan Snook, and Tayshawn Dwyer, who I've done work with in, you know, various stages in the past. But, they're contributing three short stories. And, each of them sort of feeds off of something that's hinted at in the story. So I'm happy to talk about the one I did with Simon, where there's mention of one of Barrow's previous jobs and with a revenant in a wine cellar. So Simon and I took four pages and explored what does that look like. So it was a fun little way to flesh out the world a little bit.
So you wrote these stories, basically?
Yes. Yep.
Okay. So they're all in the Grit universe, or the Gritiverse, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, the Gritiverse.
All that stuff. So getting the trade is going to be a continuation of what we've got.
Yeah, it's almost like the footnotes for the main series. Yeah.
Interesting. Well, of course, I got to ask now. You've got these other little stories. Is there a Grit 2 in your mind that you might want to explore after this gets done?
I think there's certainly places the story could go. I don't want to say too much about how this one ends, but I think that we've done enough sort of open-ended world building where we could push it in a couple different directions. I think that people will really like some of the characters we introduce in those short stories because they're sort of charming different corners of this very sort of bleak world. Like I said, I don't lean heavily into sort of grim, dark fantasy. As much as this is a sort of violent action story at the start, it becomes a more, you know, introspective sort of satire of itself. It's very self-aware the deeper you get into the story.
You see the humor in all this.
Yeah,
that's a good thing.
You see the humor and sort of the absurdity of this sort of hero worship of the guy with the sword.
So it's funny because comics live and die on action and motion and movement because visually that's an interesting thing. And yet, real life, if I always just like to say, I hate to keep using Star Trek terminology, but it's true. I loved the Deep Space Nine show, and there was action and there was danger. But if I had to choose, I would rather live on the Enterprise because it was largely a safe environment.
Oh, yeah, I know.
And I don't want to be, you know, fighting shapeshifters. And
I wouldn't last a second in this world.
Yeah, but I love that world. I mean, I love to see stories about it, but if I had to choose, I'd live on the Enterprise because I always thought it was just non-threatening. You know, everybody walks around very happy doing their jobs. They're not even getting paid. They love their work so much. And this is the very opposite of that. You know, he's doing what he wants. Now, he gets paid, of course, for it.
Yeah.
But he does enjoy his work, but let's I always like people who don't follow the norm. You know, if he's enjoying himself, you mentioned he's going to smile one time, but he's still enjoying himself, and you get that from what he's doing, even though he's got a scowl on his face most of the time, because that's just the way he is.
I don't know that he enjoys it so much as he, you know, he's never done anything else. So I think maybe there's some satisfaction in a job well done, but I think to him it's very much work. Yeah. Out of context, the first issue is sort of intentionally set up to put this hero on a pedestal, and then I'd spend two more issues kind of tearing down that portrait.
Or exploring.
Yeah, yeah. No, I don't want to say tearing down because he's still very much a central figure. I'm, and I'm not – again, I don't like the heavy-handed approach to, well, he's actually the villain. That's certainly not the case. I think it's just more complicated than, you know, this guy bad, this guy good.
See, you've touched on something I always find interesting. Some people think that the most interesting people in the world are the ones who talk a lot. But in my life, I've always found if I am around someone that doesn't talk that much, and of course, I wouldn't be able to do a podcast with people who didn't want to talk about it. But again, this is one of those things where real life is different from what we want to do in different circumstances. I find people that don't speak very much, there's a deepness to their characters and to the way they do things that if you can explore it a little bit or even ask the right questions, you might get to understand better.
Oh, yeah.
So this is me and asking questions. I love to ask people questions because you get an idea a little bit more about it. That's why we do the podcast, is so people can get a little bit more, hopefully, out of the comic when they get to read it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
So that's, I'm kind of with that. So this, I'm really looking forward to it. I love the first issue. I got to highly recommend it. If you like something, like I always talk about variety and how important that is to me, this book is great for variety's sake, if nothing else. I mean, some people are going to like the action and the adventure and the violence going on in it a lot. For me, it's because it was something I don't read very much. That's what drew me to it. You know, and like I said, the character who is not verbose, and that makes me intrigued as to what's really going on in there. So there's a level beneath this that I'm really drawn to. I know it's there. And I imagine when you introduce the other character in the next two issues that we're going to get to explore that level that's obviously there more.
Yeah. So issue two takes a sort of interesting – issue two is a little like, you know, bungee jumping where it kind of – it starts on a lighter note and then it dives into what I would say is the book's most somber couple of sequences and then pulls you right back out into this sort of over-the-top fantasy again. I'm proud of the series as a whole, but I think issue two does a lot of interesting things to, again, Barrow is a man of few words, but I think that, again, the way that he interacts with his environment will speak volumes to his character.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So pay attention.
Yeah. Yeah. He's thrust into some situations in which you really do get a sense of how tired he is. And I think that's where the sort of meat of his character, you know, he's a less impressive figure than I set him up as.
See, I don't know if I buy that. I like I said, sometimes when there's the depth that they don't necessarily make visible right off the bat, I always find that more intriguing than, say, somebody who is, you know, constantly telling jokes. And so I don't find Spider-Man very interesting at all, have to say. I mean, he's just a jokester, and you know he's friendly and he's nice and stuff. But sometimes, if you can find somebody like Barrow who is less outgoing, and when you get through that upper layer, there's actually a lot more depth in there.
Yeah.
Than that. And that's what, like I said, it just draws me to the character naturally. I'm just kind of like, I want to know what is really going on in there.
I think you'll be pleased to see the gauntlet that we run him through.
Good. Well, I'm looking forward to it. So it's going to start in May, and that means it'll go May, June, July.
Yep.
Do you have any idea when the trade's going to hit?
Shortly after, but not set in stone. Yeah, it won't be a long.
So this would be a good thing for this book, again, is a Halloween-type book to me.
Okay.
If the trade comes out around Halloween, that would be an ideal time for that.
Yeah.
I think that would be
don't give it to kids. Don't give it to kids.
No. Let's just say, like, right away, we've got blood written logo on the top. No. And there are
lots,
certain.
Lots of fun, but also lots of blood.
Yeah. And also certain four-letter words appear along the way.
A handful. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We don't want kids getting into that too much.
No,
but
no.
As far as this is definitely a more adult.
Yeah, absolutely.
Discerning audience for this group, but it's just it was fun to read, and like I said, it intrigues me. It makes me want more, and that's why I'm really looking forward to two and three. Now I know there's more stories coming in the trade. I'm gonna have to be after the trade too, because I want to see what else you've got in mind.
Yeah, it was an interesting way to. And like I said, each of these issues feels very tonally different, but I wanted to sort of explore, you know, almost different genres within it in a really short format, which I think is an interesting way to take advantage of a sort of sprawling fantasy world. Mm-hmm.
Now, I always have to ask, Barrow and the other characters that are in there, are they your imagination being brought to light? Are they based on people you know? How did you come up with the characters and who they are?
Sure. So Barrow falls into my absolute favorite trope in comics and maybe even, you know, fiction as a whole. I'm obsessed with Melville and Moby Dick, and I do very much see Barrow as this sort of Ahab figure where he's chasing something that may or may not be there. And I love characters like Hellboy who have this sort of, you know, they do the job because they have to do the job, even though they know it's you know, there's something bad at the end of the day. This sort of feeling obligated to stick with a sort of grueling lifestyle. And I think that Barrow is just sort of born of my wanting to explore that trope a little bit. Because, you know, I love every character who's sort of on this impossible quest for something, and they may not even necessarily know what they're questing for. They just know they need to keep moving. And then the name of the witch who shows up in issue two, she's a central figure. You'll see her on some covers and previews shortly. Her name is Ari, and I wanted to come up with a foil for Barrow because he is this sort of, you know, desensitized to violence and, you know, a man of few words, like I've said a couple of times. And Ari is very much this sort of, again, I think I've referred to her as an aggressive pacifist in that she is very, very serious about pushing her belief that we shouldn't be solving problems through acts of violence like this, especially the sort of gratuitous violence that we see early on in Grit. And she does that with more humor. Well, I mean, not intentional humor, but the way that she comes across and the way that she interacts with the world as someone who has this interesting magical prowess. There are a lot of scenes, and I haven't been shy about this, where Ari and birds make fun of Barrow. And it's there have been some of my favorite scenes to write where he does something that she disagrees with, so she talks trash with a crow who happens to be flying by.
Interesting. Yeah.
It was just creating a good foil who I thought would be fun for the story.
You know, what's interesting to me, too, is that another thing that drives me nuts about comics is that, like, when mutants get their powers, they turn into male models and female models. And I have to say that Ari and Barrow are not models.
No, they're not.
That's how we say. But to me, that's interesting to me. One of the things I always notice about British television, for example, they don't want the best looking, and they freely said that in public. Yeah. The actors, they want them for their acting ability, not necessarily for their good looks.
Yeah.
That's different in America. Here in America, we kind of want people that look good on the television. You know,
right. That's why we took Henry Cavill from all the British shows.
That's right. And but so your characters are, you know, you're talking about kind of blue collar kind of people.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And they're not necessarily going to be, they're not going to worry about their looks quite as much as other people might.
No. I mean, we're introduced to, in the first couple of pages, you know, a farmer and a monster hunter. And there's no reason for either of them to look like supermodels because, you know, they're working folk.
Yep. See, I like that. But that's different. See, I'm so used to, you know, Bruce Wayne looks the chiseled look to the face, and, you know, Clark Kent, even when he's Clark Kent, looks like, you know, he's this great big hulking guy, you know, even though he's got glasses on and stuff. Everybody in Wonder Woman looks great. I would have loved it if she hadn't looked quite so beautiful. I don't know. See, that would have been, but that would be a whole different story.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. That.
She wouldn't be a wonder.
Barrow sort of is built the way I like my Wolverine to be built. He's sort of a short, wide fella. Yeah, I wanted this world to feel like these people have lived and not that they've just, you know, stepped out from behind the mirror grooming themselves.
Yes. Well, you know, for, honestly, like I said, variety, that's for me, that's great fun to read. And that's why one of the reasons I think this is going to be a fun book, I got to be sure to make sure I get these, because they're going to be enjoyable reads. And not only the story is going to be interesting, but the visuals are going to be great fun as well.
So it's you'll even see over the course of the covers the sort of – we've done some interesting things with shifting the color palettes around. It's a very fun book to look at, and it just gets more fun to look at as it goes.
Well, great. So it's called Grit, G-R-I-T, and you want to make sure that you let your store know, because the deadline's coming up. March 18th, I think, is the deadline.
Yep.
We were talking about. So we got to make sure we get the orders in before that. You don't want to take chances after that. You may be less likely to get it. So you got to make sure you let your store know, because a lot of stores don't carry everything. And so you've got to be able to get your name in there to say, I want this book. And I would say, I would recommend, if you're looking for something different and fun and adventurous and really something that's going to be a variety, add variety to your reading, I would say get Grit, because it's great stuff. It's going to be nice and different and enjoyable, I think.
Yeah, I mean, if you like the sort of classic pulp heroes like your Conan or your Fritz Leiber, you know, Fatford and Gray Mouser, if you like that stuff, if you like Hellboy, things like The Goon, modern pulpy comics, I would say it's sort of pulp adventure with a heart.
Mm-hmm. Which is a great fun. Now, the other book that you gave me a chance to read, and first thing I got to ask is that the whole story you sent me, or is that part of it?
That is the whole story.
Okay, because that – you know, part of me didn't want that to be true.
I get a lot of that.
It's called Big White. Now, tell me the story. Is this how do you get this book? Because it looks like it was printed in 2018. Was this self-published?
It was. This is my first comic. It's a 12-page short story I did with artist Vlad Legostiev, and Rachel Deering did letters for this. Another phenomenal letterer. And Vlad is wonderful. Real, distinct style that he brings to the table. But it was a self-published book. I did a very small print run. There's a handful of those floating around. But otherwise, I just published it online for free, just to sort of get it out in the world. This was my test run at comics.
It's interesting because this is a more diverse, shall we say, group of characters.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I always say it's, you know, you talked about world building, and I think that's really important, because it's easy to drop somebody in the middle of New York or Metropolis or whatever you want to do.
Yeah.
And you all that's set up for you. But when you actually build the world the way you want, you know, it's just something, it's a little different. And, you know, this world is entirely different from Grit.
Yeah, very, very much so. Yeah.
This is a much more technologically oriented things that's going on. And you're set in it's called Big White for a good reason, because it's set in the middle. Is this – do you identify North or South Pole?
So this is actually – and I've mentioned the name a couple times. I'm a huge fan of Fritz Leiber's writing, mm-hmm. and this was inspired by a short story called A Pail Full of Air. So it's a sort of nondescript city intentionally, because it could be just about anywhere. But it's about a group of people who have learned to live underground after this sort of unnatural snow has blanketed and continues to blanket their world. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's intentionally left sort of – I mean there's a lot of nebulous stuff in this story as evidenced by your disappointment with the end of it. But it's a lot of open-ended stuff in this one.
Because, and I can't spoil the ending, but let's just say – something bad happens, and then people start to come back together again, and we know things aren't the way they were when he left.
Right.
Shall we say.
Or it might be. Who's to say? Who's to say?
Because it's a fascinating story, because I was glad that – well, you do have – you know, a lot of different kinds of people involved with it, which just makes it good. And you have a thing for monsters, I'm coming to figure out.
I certainly do. I mean, Big White's been out in the world for a couple of years now, so I'm not shy about talking about that.
Okay.
I really liked this idea of sort of pushing an everyman into this terrifying situation where he's sort of heard the rumors about the terrible things in the snow, but he's, at the end of the day, he's a tow truck driver. He has to go get the truck that's stalled out there. Mm-hmm. And, I had a lot of fun just sort of putting things I liked together. Again, this was kind of my test run at creating comics, and I'm really happy with the end result. I've mm-hmm. created a frustrating little story, to be sure. And again, that was a little intentional because I wanted the end to feel a bit like a Twilight Zone episode where mm-hmm. you go, okay, well, did he come out of this okay? Did he not come out of this okay? Mm-hmm. What's going to happen with his family, et cetera, et cetera?
You're getting our imagination involved.
Yeah, yeah.
What you're doing, so that's good. Because now, some stories don't leave much to the imagination. You know, it ends in a certain way. Everything wraps up in a nice little bow and everything cleared up. This story does not end up that way.
It does not. If you need a conclusion, just go ahead and pass on this one because I'm not going to give it to you.
Well, we develop our own conclusion.
That's so true. And it's been interesting to talk to folks about it. The fine folks over at Scout, once they got their hands on this, were sort of like, and then? And I said, well, you're going to have to write it, I guess.
Well, that's where I am. See, I know what I think is going to happen, and I don't want that to happen. So I'm hoping, is there more to this? Some of the best stories leave you guessing, leave you wondering. So that's what this is really good at. If you want a story that's going to engage the imagination, I think this is a really, really good one. How do people get a hold of this? I mean, you made it available to me, but...
So my website is just brianwickman.com. It's available as a free PDF download on there. There's, like I said, I've got a couple of them left if anybody wants to buy it. There's a store link on the website, but just a handful of those floating around, and otherwise they're going to come with me to conventions at some point.
Okay, well, you need to the very next question. Do you have any convention appearances scheduled for this year?
Nothing scheduled this year. I'm going to be floating around New York and Baltimore, so you could probably catch me around the Scout table slinging grit.
Okay, that'll be good. It's good. It's great that this is coming out through Scout, because I think Scout has some of the most creative stuff out there these days.
Yeah. I caught wind of Scout through Long Lost a couple of years back. Ah. I read that book and I immediately thought, well, I would like to get involved. And I pitched some things their way and, wound up with grit coming out soon.
Very good. Well, of course, that you might have others coming as time goes along.
Yeah, I've got a handful of pitches cooking in the oven right now.
All right, well, that's good. Well, the good thing about a writer is that my favorite thing is when they say, well, I can't talk about it. That means something is percolating, and that usually means to me, there's good news coming, but we can't do it right now.
Yeah, I've got two or three can't talk about it right now.
Oh, good. Well, that's good stuff. I mean, yep. that means that we have something to look forward to, hopefully.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we hope so. So that's good stuff. Well, I need to find out, too, if people want to follow you on social media, how do they do that?
Yeah, it's at BM Wickman just about everywhere. So Twitter, Instagram. Yep, you can find me either of those, BM Wickman.
Facebook?
No real page on Facebook. I should get around to that. Thanks, Wayne.
Well, see, I'm a Facebook guy. That's why I ask Facebook. Yeah. I have to always ask.
I'll get that running.
Because it's, for me, that's it makes more sense. I put stuff out on every social media platform when I'm advertising an episode. I put every platform I can figure out, and there's several I haven't been able. I don't understand what TikTok is. I have the frickin' clue.
Yeah, me either. Don't worry about that one.
I can't figure out how to do that. I've looked at it and tried to poke at it, and I've gone, like, I don't get this thing. I don't know how this works. So everything else I can figure out, I've done. Even stuff I never go to except to advertise, I put stuff out there. Just trying to get the thing. Well, that's good. Well, Brian, you're doing good stuff. And, man, very challenging. I love something that makes me think. You know, there's so little of that. Some of the comics I read are just, running in place. You know, you start out someplace, you got to end up back there again. Batman has to end up where he started so that somebody else can pick him up and do him along the way. But your stuff, I don't know what you're going to do, and that's half the fun.
Yeah, I hope so. I'm not one to flip genres on their heads, but I like to subvert expectations a little bit and sort of push these ideas that are sort of well-worn territory in fun new directions. I'm not reinventing the wheel, but I'm trying to make a fun wheel.
Well, you're trying to go where some wheels haven't gone before.
Yeah, yeah.
This is a good thing. See, I need that. I have read comics for many decades, and many times I can pick up a book and I can tell you, okay, this is going to go this way, and this is going to be that. There's nothing more disappointing when I get to the last page and I was right.
Well, you'll have some twists and turns in Grit.
Oh, good. See, that's going to be fun for me because I love to be surprised.
We'll have to check in post-issue 3.
Okay, well, that'd be good. I'd like to do that. Maybe we'll have to do. Maybe when something else comes out, we can talk about it, and we'll do a retrospect back on it.
Sounds great.
As well as part of it. Well, you know, Brian, keep it up. I have to say, I really like what you're doing. I really enjoy it. I highly recommend it. Grit, again, is the thing from Scout Comics. Be sure to let your store know before the 18th so that you can make sure you're going to get start off with the beginning, because this is going to be a story I'm sure you're going to want all 3 issues so you get the most out of it. So, well, just keep it up, Brian, and man, I can't wait to see more of your stuff as it comes out. And I hope I get to talk with you again, because I think this is good stuff. I love to be challenged. I love to, like the old Star Trek thing, go where I haven't been before.
Well, thanks, Wayne. I appreciate it.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne, as a man. From flesh and blood, I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
That's it for this week. Be sure to be back next week for special episode 425. But until then, keep reading your comics.